Okay, ready? Everybody settle and action.
Warning, Critique Revolve contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended,
you're one ugly motherfucker. Go ahead. Make my day.
Well, that's great. That's just fucking great, man.
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It doesn't matter.
Most becoming night. Most atomic.
Wow!
There are
several
short round.
Very
smashed.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
They put big stuff in the show.
The army teaches you to grin and bear it. The war with crime, and we were the phantom soldiers.
Ray never spoke to me about what happened over there.
I can't help you. Till he's telling me what happened.
Is that a question?
All right, hello, welcome everyone to Critique Revolve, Rayman Digital's movie and media podcast. I am Michael, your host, and in the studio with me is Thomas. Hello.
Hello.
And we are going to be discussing the psychological drama film directed by Ronan Day Lewis titled Anemone, which is a 2025 film. And it is Ronan's directorial debut. And it's from a screenplay he co-wrote with his father, Daniel Day-Lewis. Drum roll.
My
or
God.
Or applause. Drum rolls usually come before the name.
Right. So.
Yeah, I meant.
Fix that in editing. It'll be fine.
Yeah, I'll just have AI do it. That's what everyone's doing nowadays.
Oh, God. Kill me.
Yeah. And also, Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, didn't just write or co-write. He also starred in the lead role. It features the latter's return to acting for the first time since 2017's Phantom Thread, alongside Sean Bean and Samantha Morton. The film had its world premiere at the 2025 New York Film Festival on September 28th, followed by a very limited theatrical release, a platform release, if you will, in the United States on October 3rd, and Focus Features will be expanding a week later on October 10th. So this is going to be a difficult film to discuss because it's an art house film.
Mm-hmm. Notoriously complex or convoluted or kerfuffled.
Yeah. Choose your adjective depending on how you feel about the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is an intriguing film that seeks to, I would say, unravel, expose, and dissect through aesthetic as well as performative means, real world trauma rooted in abuse and violence. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, yes, without getting into too much spoilers, yeah, I would.
Yeah, so it's a very human story, one that doesn't sensationalize pain, but instead it's more exploratory. So it explores how it shapes human identity, memory, as well as relationships, and then through the intimate performances and deliberate formal choices, the film invites us to confront the, I guess, the lingering aspects of trauma, and not necessarily as a distant observer like typical audiences perceive things when they watch a movie, but as participants in an emotional excavation, because that's what it does. It throws us in the movie. It builds an atmosphere, builds and builds and builds. And at times, the tide of this aesthetic buildup washes over us. For better or worse, do we drown? Do we get washed away? Do we become completely enthralled? And Thomas and I will have probably very opposing views on a movie like this. If our listeners are not aware, we have very different opinions on art house films and indie films. So broadly speaking, the way I feel about this movie, it is intensely expressionistic. It effectively builds a world that conveys the emotional texture of its characters with remarkable clarity. I think that's where the movie definitely shines. When they speak, we listen, and not out of, you know, obligation because there's someone on the screen, but because the film has earned our attention. And this attentiveness is deeply tied to the performances themselves. This is what Daniel Day-Lewis does. This is why you have Daniel Day-Lewis in a movie. And I have said this numerous times. I can watch Daniel Day-Lewis watch paint dry, and he would make it entertaining.
Well, boy, did you get your wish.
It really did test that theory, right?
Kind of.
Because I said a similar sentiment, or I had a similar sentiment back when There Will Be Blood premiered. I've always had a difficult relationship with that movie because I do enjoy it, but there are times where I want to shoot myself in the head. Mm-hmm. I found it incredibly boring at times, but what kept me engaged is Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right.
The moment he's on screen, he reels me back in. And I would say the same thing when it comes to this movie. Now, I didn't find this movie boring. It's very slow in a meditative way. It's purposely designed. I don't want to use the word slow burn because that is used way more than its value. This is something I would call meditative. It's building the atmosphere. It's building the feelings. It's hoping to evoke the emotions that our characters are in fact going through.
I would not say this is a slow burn for a couple of reasons. One, a slow burn insinuates that eventually it'll become something like a roaring fire. This is more of like a simmer or like a sauna. Like the sauna doesn't really necessarily get that much hotter, but the atmosphere is almost suffocating at times.
Oh, I don't like that.
I mean, I think it works,
yeah.
Right? Oh, my Lord.
So the way I look at this movie ultimately is the actors ground the film's aesthetic explorations. Everything we see, we hear, we feel in human presence and intensity. So much like when Daniel Day-Lewis speaks, we lean in. You know, he doesn't simply ask for our attention. He commands it through sheer captivation. And for me, this is where the film excels, in the performative aspects. Thomas, what are your initial thoughts?
Well, so I will agree that the performative aspects are where the movie had my interest the most. I would argue that part of it is not necessarily because of the atmosphere that was built up to where we're drawn in, but partly because now something's finally happening. And I know that sounds really negative, but I'm both serious and not trying to be super negative when I say that, is because it does it deliberately in the beginning, and it very much does resemble that kind of like estranged family dynamic where when you haven't seen someone for years or you left on bad terms, you're not just gonna be like, hey, buddy, how's it going? Let's have a drink. So how's the family or how are the folks? You're not like that. It's kind of awkward. There's resentment. There's no one knows what to say or how to get it started. So when someone finally does talk, it's breaking that tension finally. Part of the problem, I think, with the atmosphere is that this doesn't ever, like the sauna, it doesn't ever let up on that. And while it's effective in the beginning for setting up our situation, I think so much of it is there kind of as almost padding, or, and not even necessarily padding, but it's there to be there. And I don't think it's there for us as the audience to take something away from it. There's a lot of art house elements of things that I criticize all the time, the long ponderous shots into the middle distance with a wistful look in your eye. On one hand, an art house film or someone who's good at those types of movies can do something with that, and it serves ultimately a greater narrative purpose or a thematic or symbolic purpose later in the film. And I think this has some of those moments, but then I think there are some where it's just, okay, what was the point of that, or where did that go? Oh, it went to a cul-de-sac of nowhere. And that's one of my personal issues when it comes to art house films, is that the fine line between someone who did something with intention that when you look back, you're like, oh, that's what that represented or meant. I really get it now. That's clever. Is very easily confused with someone who doesn't know what the fuck they're doing. They look the same. And I think this movie kind of fluctuates between the two, because I would never say it's poorly made, but I wouldn't say the script holds up to scrutiny.
I'll give you that. It probably needed to be grounded a bit more or anchored to something more tangible. There is a lot of abstraction in a movie like this. And in order to reify that abstraction, which is in fact emotions, what the actors, you know, are hopefully feeling is what we feel. You have to reify it. You have to ground it in order for us to fully understand. Now, just to rebuttal you for a moment here with the lack of letting up and the repetition of scenes and the ponderous looks, do you not feel that that was possibly intentional? And what I mean by that mm-hmm. is you're dealing with a movie that's incredibly dark. Theme-wise, you're dealing with obviously trauma, but also right. deep-rooted depression,
right.
sadness. If you're trying to delve into that and dissect that, you're not going to let it up. You want the audience to become suffocated and feel exactly how Daniel Day-Lewis's character feels. He can't escape. He can't escape his past. He's trying to. He's trying to feel something else, but he's not. You know, he's feeling
right.
these dark thoughts. And I feel like a lot of those so-called ponderous shots and the lack of letting up is sheerly intentional. Now, whether or not that is a good decision mm-hmm. from the director, that I feel like is an interesting conversation. I do not feel like this is the typical art house film or indie film no. that you and I have been talking about of late, where there's a lot of like Rian Johnson isms where, oh, I just thought it looked cool. I don't know what it means.
Well, that's a perfect example for what I was saying.
Yeah. I feel like this movie's not that. I don't no. feel like this director is a hack. I don't feel like he was just doing things because it looked cool. I believe he had intention behind everything he was doing. Whether or not that's going to go over well with the audience, that's a whole other question.
Well, and that's the thing, is that I don't think that I think the stuff that was done in this movie was done deliberately and by choice. But the thing is, when it comes to weird esoteric or art house moments or symbolism that you're not quite certain about in movies, that usually falls into three categories. I don't get it at first, but then when I look back or someone explains it or I watch it a second time, it all falls into place. Damn, that was good now that I see it. They were a complete fucking hack and there was no point to any of it. The Rian Johnson
approach.
Which
is the most common.
Which is the most common. And unfortunately, those two look very, very similar unless you watch it twice. And then there's a third category, which is kind of like, did you make this just for yourself? Because while there is probably a reason here, we as the audience have been left in the dust for your auteur moment. And I think we've seen a lot of that with things like Eddington earlier this year. And previously, Beau is Afraid. It's like this, you're doing something that you want and there's a reason for it. You left everyone else behind. And I think that's one of those things, is that the general idea or the plot of this movie, I'm okay with and I'm interested in even. But I don't think there's enough conflict to keep people entertained for most of the movie.
And you mean traditional audiences?
Traditional audiences. Yeah. Now, if you're an art house fan, you'll probably enjoy more of it. But I think even for art house fans, it kind of goes a little bit too much. And that's where that sauna metaphor comes into play, because it doesn't get hotter or cooler. You're just there.
Yeah. There were moments where I scratched my head. I was wondering, okay, what is this? What does this symbol mean? Mm-hmm. But I will say that I was never annoyed during the movie. I never felt like this guy was just fucking around and messing with us.
There's other movies where that has happened.
Yeah.
And I agree. I do not think this falls into that.
And I do wish there was a camera on us. Because while I was laughing and chuckling, you were sighing.
Yes. Because I was bored.
I don't
bored.
Think we've ever. I know. I know you were. Mm-hmm. I was laughing. I was enjoying it. And I'm like, oh,
for me,
he's not liking it.
For me, it was very much like a flat line. And then there was these really big peaks when Daniel Day-Lewis does his thing.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it, it's like a whale where there's a heartbeat every like 4 minutes.
Jesus.
Except, you know, 30 minutes.
Yeah. All right. So just to give our listeners a better idea of what type of movie we're dealing with, because there are a lot of confusion or lots of confusion around different filmic sensibilities and styles, especially in today's very cluttered social media where everyone tries their hand at reviewing things and they're not quite sure what they're reviewing. And also for the purpose of our listeners to understand what type of film this is, because by the end, we'll recommend whether this is something our listeners would actually enjoy. But before we can do that, people need to understand what an art house film truly is. They are different than indie films. They can be an indie film, and usually they are indie films. This is an art house film, and with it, there are art house sensibilities that viewers and reviewers alike seem to no longer understand. A patience for form, an embrace of ambiguity, and a willingness to sit with images and moods rather than demand immediate narrative payoff. Now, lately, there's been this growing trend, and this is why I'm bringing this up, fueled in part by social media habits and the constant need to churn out content, where people approach indie and art house films with the same expectations they bring to big studio blockbusters. They try to categorize them the same way, using box office numbers as some kind of ultimate metric, which I've already seen with this film.
Mm-hmm.
As if financial performance is the end all for artistic success. But that's not what these films are built to do. The same issue comes up when people talk about the script. A lot of reactions are filtered through the lens of a standard Hollywood screenwriting script or template. Neat three-act structures, clear character arcs, tidy resolutions. And when a film doesn't follow those conventions, it's often dismissed as flawed or messy, when in reality, it's operating on a completely different level or wavelength. Art house cinema often communicates through suggestion, mood, rhythm, and what's left unsaid. It asks for a different kind of viewing literacy, essentially.
Yeah.
And if that's not your thing, if you're listening to our review, then you're not going to like this movie. Now let's bring it back to Anemone. There we go. I knew I was going to mess up that name at least once. Anemone. All right, so when it comes to a film like Anemone, or really when it comes to analyzing or reviewing a film of this kind, there are a few core questions worth asking, and this is what I want to go through. And if you answer them honestly, they can usually tell you whether the film's form is actually working. Okay. And this is where I'm going to really need you to dig in as well, okay? So first, what was the intention of the film, and how did it communicate that intention? Second, was the overall narrative coherent in its execution? And third, did you empathize with or care about the characters? So right away, Anemone makes its intention clear. And what's interesting is how closely that intention aligns with the plot itself. It's a skimpy plot, but it does, in fact, align with that skimpy plot. Now, that's not always the case. Very often, a plot is just there to anchor the more abstract layers like themes and ideology. And I do feel like this is what that movie did. It wasn't about the plot. But here, the intention is to explore trauma, right? That's what we've talked about, whether generational, personal, and its lasting effects.
The effects it has, and that it, like a ripple, it affects more people than just the one who was involved, you know?
So, Thomas, what was the intention of the film, and how did it communicate that intention? Do you feel like it had intention, and did it communicate that intention properly?
I mean, my first stab at it, I would say, I feel the intention of the film is to have an exploration of trauma, that you cannot run away from it, no matter how hard you try, that when you do, it'll affect other people, that you don't realize what your decisions and how they will affect other people. And I think it's an exploration of one man's attempt to try and both absolve himself, but also act like he doesn't need it, and the fallout that has for the people around him. Does it execute on that? I mean, I think it does. Ultimately, I think it does, because we are able to walk away understanding that. There's some very there's some very obvious scenes. There's some very eclectic scenes. You know, I'll say that.
Eclectic. That's a good word. I would call it confusing.
Batshit bonkers.
Confounding.
So I think overall, yeah, I understood what it was going for and I see what it was doing. I just feel that there's a lot of empty space for these visuals or this idea element of pacing and tone and a vibe that doesn't necessarily contribute to that story or that point.
So the movie was 126 minutes.
Way too long for what it has.
I agree. I feel like you could have done the exact same thing. Built the same atmosphere. Suffocate us, if you will. They use the sauna metaphor.
Yeah.
And you could have made this movie probably under 2 hours. And I feel like it would have had the exact same effect.
I think a tight 90 minutes or even 100 minutes of this, I think that would have helped it immensely. I think it would have cut down a lot of the parts that didn't work for me and just kind of like the waiting around for things to happen. Because, and that's what the problem is that.
Do you think it was waiting around for things to happen? Because I get what you're saying, but don't you believe
it's not that the movie was waiting around for things to happen. It's that I was while watching this movie.
Okay, now
and,
I get it.
And that's kind of, because art house is not my thing.
Yeah.
Now, if it is something that ultimately pays off with a great reveal or it all comes together in the end, then I'm more willing to go back and give it a higher marks kind of thing. But I think it had been a little bit tighter on its runtime, cut out some of the more ambiguous stuff that really didn't go anywhere. There's a couple scenes that really work for that atmosphere building vibe. And when we learn about what happens later in the movie, certain earlier scenes kind of make sense. But then there's some that are just there and could have been removed and you would have missed nothing.
Yeah, I do agree with that, Thomas. So the opening 27 minutes, there was, I think, one line of dialogue.
Yeah.
And for me, that worked. And I feel like if you would have stopped with that style after that 27, 30 minute mark, the movie would ultimately play better. Because that type of slow meditative approach was necessary to help us understand what world we're in, what type of setting we're entering.
Well, I think
and it also paved way for Daniel Day-Lewis to come out from behind the red curtain and start performing for the first time on stage. Mm-hmm. Because that's what the intention really felt. It felt like it was a bit of a meta angle, like, hey guys, now it's time for Daniel Day-Lewis to do his thing, because 27 minutes of silence building up the scenes.
Well, very little talking. Yeah.
Very little talking. And then you have 15 minute monologue.
I think the first one's something like 10.
And it was truly captivating. Even you went from sheer boredom to like, okay, I'm here. I felt the emotion change.
Yes.
Your whole mood changed. I fully admit that. You laughed with certain lines that were meant to be crude and humorous. So the problem's definitely not the performance, because the theater itself was also like shaking its head. I was looking around.
There's a lot of it.
As soon as Daniel Day-Lewis opened his mouth, people were connected to the movie. And that right there might be part of the problem with the film. The fact that perhaps doing that meditative approach in a film that was marketed as Daniel Day-Lewis's return to acting, perhaps this movie ended up being a letdown to many of the people who went to go see the movie. Because when we walked out, there were people that were not happy. There were actually people who walked out of the movie. Did you notice a few people leaving the movie?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, there were about 4 or 5 people that just got up. And I only knew they were leaving and not going to the bathroom because they had their purse, their cell phone, their popcorn, and they were
like, everything.
Yeah, they were walking out with moodiness.
Yes. Now, and that's...
And that doesn't reflect the movie, in my opinion. I think it reflects bad marketing. Meaning...
I think it's both.
People needed to know what this was.
I think it's both, truthfully, because... Had they had that first long, ponderous bit, and then when Daniel Day-Lewis starts talking and we break that silence, the movie kind of picks up speed and steps away from some of that atmospheric building.
But then it returns.
I think that would have been helpful. Yeah. And especially because that would have worked for the narrative of these two brothers haven't talked to each other in years, perhaps 20 years or something like that. We don't quite know the exact number. But that would have been something that back watching it again, you'd be like, oh, okay, now I see why they're so quiet, because there's all this unspoken stuff and it would have helped the narrative. But instead they come back to it. So right when you think you're going to get off this out of the sauna, you're right back into it. And I think that is what loses some people. Now you can say there's marketing as an element of that, but I'm also I'm a fairly strong believer in, if people didn't get it, then you did something wrong when it comes to your narrative. And if people are bored, people are bored, man. No amount of explaining that is going to fix it.
Yeah.
So
no, you're not wrong.
You know, now what was the second question?
The second question was the overall narrative coherent in its execution? And I think you kind of answered
that. I think honestly, all except maybe two parts.
Mm-hmm.
One very obvious, like, what in the hell?
Yeah. Now let me jump on that for a second, because that is where I will formally complain.
Send a letter to the manager.
I'm all about esoteric symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it.
But what the hell was that?
I view types of films like this as almost like a piece of art. You go to an art gallery and you sit there and you try to be smart and interpret it. I enjoy it. I enjoy doing stuff like that. But you can't just throw symbolism in there.
Right.
Unless it has already been anchored to the narrative itself. So we can have a shot at properly interpreting the symbolism. And typically in movies, there's a lot of semiotics that's put into the background of, let's even say, mainstream films. And they're purposely done for those people who pay attention to the background and little things that add more oomph, more life to the story. But if you don't recognize that stuff in the background, you still understand the overt, you know, referential meaning. But when you're dealing with a movie like this, an art house film, that is going to, you're going to have to understand some of the latter portions of its symbolism. You need to start anchoring those aspects early on so that when we get to those symbolic moments, we can have a fair shot at interpreting it. Because there are scenes in the movie, we saw the movie, what, about a week ago?
A week ago.
And I've been thinking about numerous scenes, and I'm still at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
There's one specific scene, which this isn't a spoiler, where there's just a fish floating in the river that's been gutted or possibly even eaten. We're not even quite sure. And Daniel Day-Lewis's character is sitting in this river or standing in this river watching it float by. And as it gets closer, it seemingly grows larger, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's another scene where you have this metaphysical
entity.
Yeah. Elk or animal, a creature in the woods that's glowing, and they bring a lot of attention to its testicles and penis.
Like, what are we talking about even right now?
Yeah. Well, and I thought, okay, are we dealing with regeneration, fertility, renewal, because we're dealing with generational trauma? Like, okay, I can start throwing darts, but there's nothing that makes me feel like I got it right.
You can throw darts, but if there's no dart board, you're not going to hit anything.
Yeah. You need, and this is coming from me, who I love this type of shit,
right,
but you have to help us a little bit. And I feel like there were a few scenes towards the end that you really didn't help us out with. And maybe there'll be someone on the internet that says, you guys are idiots, this is what it means. But listen, the filmic IQ in this studio right now, we could figure things out together.
7-0.
If we put our brains together, our combined intellect, we can figure out these scenes. And yet it's been a week and we're still at a loss.
Yeah.
So things like that, I think, hinder the film, especially when they come so late in the movie. For someone like me, my patience wasn't wearing thin, so I didn't get annoyed, but I could imagine viewers like you, Thomas.
Well, I was like, well, let me tell you, as someone whose patience was worn paper thin, there's some of the things, it's weird. Like I said, that metaphor of like a whale's heartbeat, the parts where Daniel Day-Lewis gets to do his thing or Sean Bean gets to do something are fantastic. It's another example of why he's a great actor, how he can captivate the attention of a room with literally fuck all to his personality or anything happening, but one man talking to another character, you are enthralled because he's that good. Now, admittedly, the two stories he told are also very good. But beyond that, that's when I say, like, there's so much wasted space that is filled up with stuff that maybe means something to the director, but has left the rest of us behind. And it's one of those things where there's a lot of biblical elements of, like, the prodigal son returns. If you know that story, I don't want to spoil too much, but there's a lot of the fish element, the absolution. There's Christian symbolism in the very beginning of the movie, and that's a running theme in the family dynamic. There's a lot there that I think they could have done more with. And again, had it been like a shorter runtime and fill in, you can't have that many staring off ponderously into the middle distance scenes, man. You got to reduce those. You got to fill them with more context.
There you go.
Or something that when I come back to it, or in retrospect, I can say, oh, fuck, that's what that was.
Because I even think that you could have many of those scenes, but rather than let them run for 90 seconds, 180 seconds.
It had to be shorter.
20 seconds. Count to 20, Thomas. That's a long,
long-ass time.
20 seconds would do the trick. But there's times where I felt like we were sitting for
minutes,
a couple minutes. And I do not, this is where I do agree with you. I do not feel that that's ultimately necessary, because it's going to make your screenplay feel incredibly thin. Like you don't have much here.
And that's part of my problem, is that when it feels like you don't have much there and it's a longer runtime, you're only hurting yourself. Now, admittedly, these kind of movies are never going to make money. They're not designed with the intent to. Every black swan that makes a shitload of money off of a microscopic budget is a one in a thousand. You know, that rarely happens. Honestly, these are made for award season. The award season notoriety is their marketing, because I said this before, how many people saw Anora before it won Best Picture?
Yeah, no one.
No one fucking saw that movie. It wins Best Picture. Everyone's watching it and it's recommended on Amazon Prime. That's how these things work. I think that element would help it, yes, down the long road, but ultimately it's just threadbare enough to where you'll get bored because of the runtime, I feel, with peaks of Daniel Day-Lewis and great acting and brother dynamics and some of that stuff, the family dynamic. And that's why I always look at, because I always come back from, is it a story well told? Is this scene serving your movie or your story? If it was tighter with a little bit more added in and more tightly wrapped up, I think this would have been just fine.
So you kind of answered the third question, and it seems like you agree with this, or your answer would be yes. Did you empathize with or care about the characters?
Most.
The characters that mattered, because
the characters that mattered,
90%
yes.
of the screen time was Daniel Day-Lewis talking. And I'm talking about performance screen time, of course. It was Daniel Day-Lewis talking or doing some task, and Sean Bean either reacting or observing.
Yeah.
And both of them. People don't get credit for simply observing in movies. And I know that sounds stupid, because we think of acting as doing something, right? Moving, frenetic.
There's more to it than that.
Talking, though. Right. And this is what I want to focus on in terms of Sean Bean's character. You cared about him as well. And he had a fraction of the dialogue that Daniel Day-Lewis did. But it goes to show you what a good performer can do for simply the reactions and the observation moments of a film. So empathize, I think ultimately, I think we would both agree that we did in fact care about the characters. There are two characters, one more than the other, that one could have been completely eliminated.
There are five characters in this movie. Daniel Day-Lewis gets a shitload of screen time and he's awesome. Sean Bean doesn't get nearly as much, but he's awesome. There's a character that could be cut entirely and you never would have known.
Yeah.
And then
girlfriend of the son, right? Yeah.
We don't even know that she's a girlfriend.
We just assume.
And then the son and the mother are there for plot purposes, but I really didn't care about, like, I understood.
They were simply supporting. They were, remember we were talking about anchoring?
Yeah.
They were simply there to help anchor the overall narrative, because it was about Daniel Day-Lewis. He was the centerpiece.
That's again, though, where I'm like, you have an opportunity, and it doesn't necessarily that everything has to be this way, but you have an opportunity for a B plot there to entertain me or to give me a reason to want to see what's happening here. And then when I come back to Daniel Day-Lewis, I'm interested because I've been away from that story for a little bit.
See, I agree with that. When you're looking at a movie that's 126 minutes, you have more than enough time there, obviously, to help flesh out some of those background players. And even though I totally understand what the director wanted to do and his intention, I do feel like, hey, listen, you gave us 126 minutes. You couldn't have taken 5 minutes to help flesh out the son a little more, to help us really see those comparisons that they were, that they were trying to convey.
Cause they tell us they're there.
That's my biggest problem with the movie.
But I do not fucking see them.
That's where, okay. So you have a fucking movie. This is where I'm going to complain. You have a movie that's built on visual aesthetics. 80% of the film is visuals. And the moment where you can actually use those visuals to show us something, you don't. You tell us something in passing, and you're trying to convince us that the son of Daniel Day-Lewis's character is so much like him. Well, why not give us a scene that actually shows that? That is probably the biggest sore thumb in the entire movie for me.
Because it feels like a glaring missed opportunity. And again, it's a combination of things. That feels like a glaring missed opportunity. The scenes with him feel unfinished.
Correct.
It runs too long for what it has. And it goes back into that slow, ponderous level when we finally come out of that. So it's like the parts are there. And it's one of those things that we've said quite a lot, is that this needed a second pass on the script, or someone to sit down and say, all right, this is fun. This is great. I like what you got here. What is this scene for? What are we doing with this character? Do we need this? And that's one of those things where you should be taking a razor to your movie and just like whittling it down to the parts that really fucking matter. Even your ponderous scenes should have a purpose. Why the character's there, what they could be thinking about, what happened before and after that scene that makes that a relevant moment to witness.
Yeah.
And there's just some that don't need to be.
Yeah, because with a movie like this, some of those, I know you keep saying ponderous, and I don't know if I'd say ponderous, but that's just semantics.
Yeah.
Between how our differing views on the movie, I feel like those ponderous scenes are also characters. In a lot of ways, the visuals is another character in many regards. But where you take so many liberties with those visuals, which is another character, you don't do the same for the obvious and actual characters in the movie. So I would agree the screenplay is the weakest, and it does seem like, Thomas, that most critics
have that same
also
sentiment.
Yeah. So according to Rotten Tomatoes, Anemone has received mixed reviews from critics who criticized its screenplay, but praised the cinematography and performances, with many singling out, of course, the performance of Daniel Day-Lewis. And this may say a lot, Thomas. If Daniel Day-Lewis was not in this movie, would it even be worth watching?
Okay, I will. This is what I would say to that. If you had an actor or even actress, you could flip it on its head, who could do as good of an acting job, which is a tall fucking order, but let's just say anybody with the chops to make that performance work, I think that would still be okay, but that's limiting that to like a handful of people. And without that strong performance, I don't think you have anything.
Yeah, because this is 100% a performance picture.
Yes.
And if you don't have the right person in that role, then the movie itself isn't worth seeing.
Yeah.
Because the only thing of true value overall, and I'm saying this objectively, is the performance. You remove that, you don't have a movie.
You don't have anything.
Thomas, I'm going to give this movie. Are you ready?
I don't know. Am I? Let's see.
A 67%. You probably thought it was going to be higher, didn't you?
I thought it might be, but I'm not surprised either.
I did enjoy this movie quite a bit. So 67%, it's still considered fresh if you're going by Rotten Tomato standards. And according to our standards, it's considered...
It's a movie?
Yeah, it's considered just fine. And that's how I feel about it. I feel like this movie kept me surprisingly entertained despite its art house vibe. Will I watch it again? Probably not, unless it was a date night with a new gal pal. You know, that was like, hey, you know what?
And you wanted to put her to sleep.
I loved an asshole. I'm like, some people use Quaaludes. Is that still a thing? some people use Quaaludes.
I use art house films
to put my ladies to sleep. That's so bad.
It can be a prescription instead of melatonin. See, that's a little bit less rapey.
Oh, my God.
Jesus Christ.
If you're having problems sleeping at night.
Watch an enemy.
Yeah, I think it's one of those movies. It's going to be something that I would want to watch with someone else. If they're into these types of movies and they haven't watched it before. Would I put this on with my best friend? No. So I'm being honest here, right, for our listener. If I was writing an essay right now for a cinema journal, then I would be saying very different things. I'd be offering more of my own subjective feelings on this film. Mm-hmm. But for the purposes of this review and for our listeners, I'm being honest. It's a 67%. If you're into art house films and you're going to drink some wine and you're on a date with someone that
is also into
types of movies, then I think it would be, worth watching. But if this is something you want to watch on a Friday night or Saturday and your, choices are, the latest,
anything else.
Okay. All right. So what's your rating?
So I'm going to give it like a split kind of rating, which I don't usually do. I would say if you, like you said, are an art house fan and you like Daniel Day-Lewis, I would give this a 60%. It's not middle of the road. I mean, in that respect, it is better. He makes it worth watching. If you're an average person who's like, I don't really give a fuck about Daniel Day-Lewis, or that's not enough of a piece of bait to get you to go see this, it's a 40. It's still within it's a movie realm, but there's a lot without that performance and without that actor behind it. I don't know if I'd ever recommend or watch it again to the average person.
That's fair.
So that's where I'd go with that. So, yeah.
I am curious to see what Ronan Day-Lewis will do in the future. Is he going to stick to this art house vibe?
Well, so he's only done, as I was curious, he did a short called The Sheep and the Wolf, and then he's done one music video, and then he did this. So that is something else to consider. This is admittedly with his father's help. His first screenplay. And I'd love to know how much who did what, because certain scenes and certain bits of dialogue and plot are really well done. And then others are really, really short or missing meat and substance.
Do you think Daniel Day-Lewis wrote his lines?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. That's what I was
Because he also knows what he can do with it. And if he's anybody, wouldn't you want to? If you know what you can do.
Someone out there in the TikTok, Instagram, Reels world, just take all those scenes of Daniel Day-Lewis, put them into a video.
Upload it to
And you got the best parts media. Of the movie.
And you saved yourself a ticket.
And you kind of know what the story's about, too.
The second monologue is the movie.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that, takes points away, because he was saying it, I loved listening, but if anyone else was doing that, I'm like, we've waited this long for you to just tell us everything. That feels weird.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So Yeah, it's really a mixed bag on this one. You have to be an art house fan or a Daniel Day-Lewis, ideally both. And if those are not you, I can't recommend this for you.
Yeah, agreed. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Thomas.
Take care.
Hello, very nice to meet you. I'd like to know about sex change operations.
I see.
Cut. No good for sound.
Well, fucking hell, Lloyd.
Man, game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we going to do now? What are we going to do?
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
I'll be back.